Thank you, Martin. And let me thank the organizers for the invitation to be here and present the work done in collaboration with the people shown here. When I prepared this talk, I hope I could say more than I'm actually saying about asymptotic safety, but I will do my best here. So Renata has already introduced you to CGT, so I'll be a little short, but it never harm to repeat some of the things, I guess. So quantum gravity, when I was in my formative years, a long time ago, in the 80s maybe, the goal was there to basically obtain the background geometry that we observe from the theory and be able to study the fluctuations around that background geometry. And what lattice gravity, what CGT offers to you is, as Renata told you, a number transitive quantum field theory definition of quantum gravity. Whether it in the end will give a complete theory remains to be seen. A background independent formulation. And it, as I will show you in detail, an emergent background geometry and the possibility to study quantum fluctuations around the emergent background. So that's at least in the spirit of here. The problem is, of course, if it's really defines a full theory or will it only be an effective quantum field theory. And that's what I'll discuss there. So let me skip the drawbacks of the CGT formulation and go to the virtues. So the path integral is a regularized sum over geometry, piecewise linear geometry. So we need not to deal with coordinates. The Einstein-Hilbert action on such piecewise linear geometry has a very natural general form. And we have a cutoff, which is geometric, which is diffeomorphism invariant. So all nice features. We start out in Minkowski space, as Renata explained to you, but then we rotate in order to do calculations to a Friedmann space. And the set of configurations that we deal with are such that they actually allow such a rotation. And this kind of regularized lattice theory simultaneously acts as a regularization of the unboundedness of a Friedmann quantum gravity. So using this path integral representation, it also, in my opinion, has an advantage that we can actually, although we want to explore what is quantum geometry in a certain way, we can still use classical geometric concepts. We put them into the path integral, calculate expectation values of them, and we see to what extent it makes sense. And I will give you some examples of that. So after rotating to a Friedmann space, I mean, we have a statistical system. And in principle, what we want to do is to apply the general philosophy of statistical systems. And this is, of course, also underlying the exact normalization group approach, that it's really a kind of modified Wilsonian approach to this. So the statistical mechanics and fixed points are, of course, in the center of this. So it's, one could contemplate a little about to what extent does this make sense in quantum gravity. So in a theory of critical phenomena, we usually identify a fixed point by the behavior of certain observables. So we have here observables O, and they are put in lattice points, xn and yn. Sorry, that would be ym here. And in terms of lattice distances, we have n minus m. And then we have a correlation link. Yeah, and so typically we have an exponential fall off of this, and the correlation length will diverge exactly when we go to the critical point. So having such a diverging correlation length, then in the lattice theory, a continuum limit might exist. It's not sure that it exists, but there's a chance that it exists when we approach the critical point. So this D could be the temperature in the system or some of the coupling constants. So the correlation length diverges with some critical exponent. And this critical exponent, it tells us basically how we should scale the lattice spacing to zero. So if we scale it exactly like this, then the product of the correlation length and the lattice spacing stays constant. So we are here at a physical fixed distance. So the way we people in statistical mechanics would like to take this continuum limit is to say, and also in quantum field theory, repeating quantum field theory, is that one takes that this is a physical distance, and this is a lattice distance times this lattice spacing. And now this goes to zero, and this has to diverge in such a way that this stays constant. And then we are left, in this formula here, we are left with a physical mass defined in this way, which is defines the exponential decay of our function. And of course, when we go direct, all the way to the critical point, I mean, we don't have such a mass, but this mass is defined by the approach to the critical point. So that's how it works. But now, can we really apply this in quantum gravity? You could really ask yourself. Well, there's a number of questions here. So first of all, well, we need some suitable observables. And they better be diffeomorphic invariant somehow. And we know that this is a kind of generic problem, almost impossible to define local observables. It is really a problem, as also touched upon by a number of speakers. Maybe even more importantly, what exactly is the correlation length here in a diffeomorphic invariant theory? So in the whole framework of Wilsonian normalization, the fact that you have a divergent correlation length that dictates entirely the critical behavior of the system, and all the scaling relations and so on are mainly derived by the assumption that you have this divergent correlation length. But what does it mean? I mean, what is x minus y if we integrate all metrics? And how should we really define this? Another question is, maybe this lattice regularization that we are using, maybe it's impossible to recover a diffeomorphism invariant continuum theory in such a lattice regularization. I mean, one cannot really say that our lattice regularization breaks diffeomorphism invariance in the sense that we are claiming that each configuration is a geometry. But on the other hand, it's not, of course, granted that just by summing all those geometries that you, the theory you end up with is diffeomorphism invariant. And it might even be difficult or even impossible in four-dimensional theory to adjust the coupling constant in such a way that a diverging correlation length is obtained in terms of physical units. So in this way, we might not even be able to penetrate into the sub-Planckian distances for physical reasons related to the nature of quantum gravity. So I will discuss all these points, but let me just say that the first three questions have nothing really, not much to do actually with the fact that we're discussing four-dimensional quantum gravity. Of course, when it comes to diverging correlation lengths, and then we are talking about field theoretical degrees of freedom, and then maybe we better be in four dimensions where we believe that we have something like a propagating a graviton and so on, that we really have a field theoretical degree of freedom. But the first three questions can actually are independent of that. They are still in lower dimensional theories, and they can actually be answered affirmatively in 2D toy models. So I would say, personally, for me, I mean, the most important thing was the realization, kind of relating to the user randomization group and so on, that one can actually define a diverging correlation length. Here's a definition. There might be others. This is the best one I've been able to come up with. And it actually works in these 2D toy models. So we now have quantum gravity coupled to matter, and we are performing our functional integral over the geometries, over the fields. We have the action that we choose, and we now want to make define the correlation between fields in two different points. But of course, by diffeomorphic invariance, we cannot just take phi, psi 1, and psi 2. So here's a definition. So d here is a geodesic distance for the given metric. We are integrating on all metrics. So for a given metric, we have a geodesic distance. And we insist that the two points here are separated such a geodesic distance. We call it r here. So r is actually an external parameter that we put in from outside. And it turns out that this definition, well, it looks pretty trivial and innocent, and in a certain way it is. It's, of course, non-local. But it's actually quite subtle, because it turns out that in the solvable models, like 2D Euclidean quantum gravity, it turns out that the geodesic distance scales anomalously. I mean, it doesn't have the dimension of length itself, but of square root of length, simply by the fluctuating geometry that are in 2D. So it's a subtle definition, but nevertheless, it works, actually. So for instance, to be concrete, you take an easing model, a spin model, you put it on a fluctuating kind of triangulation, you sum over everything, and that should, at a critical point, we know that this should describe as C equal to 1/2, C is the central charge, equal to 1/2, conformal field theory, kind of coupled to 2D quantum gravity. And from continuum calculations, we know the critical exponents associated with this model. And you can actually, you can measure the correlation length and in this distance R, and you can see that they satisfy exactly the scaling that they should satisfy. So it is possible to think about this in quantum gravity exactly as we think about it in statistical mechanics. But of course, we pay a price for this, namely that this definition is non-local. And now I made it here for scalar fields, and for gravitational fields, it's not so obvious exactly how to make it in a way where it can be used. But in principle, such concepts make sense. So I think that's quite important to keep in mind. Now let us go to the phase diagram CGT. So Nada has already told you a little bit about it. So we have in this theory, we have the cosmological coupling constant, gravitational coupling constant, and we have put in an asymmetry factor between space and time, because we have broken this symmetry by choosing a foliation. That was part of the package of the CGT that we had. So we have these three coupling functions, but actually, and this is entirely for kind of computer technical reasons, we are trading away, we are fixing, you can say, the cosmological coupling function in the following way. That we have here the partition function as a function of the cosmological constant and the gravitational coupling constant. And we now write it, this L here should be a V, so we now write it as a Laplace transform here. Of another partition function, which is simply the one with the Einstein term, the cosmological term has been taken out. It appears here in the Laplace transform. And we are insisting here that the volume, we have a volume constraint here, that the volume is fixed to be V when we integrate all these metrics. This is the partition function that we use in the computer simulation. So we fix the total four volume for technical reasons. So here's the phase diagram. Here's an artistic view of the phase diagram. I will give you a quantitative phase diagram on the next slide, or the few slides. So here are the three coupling functions I talked about. Up here, the cosmological coupling function. Here, what is called K naught, this is the inverse bare gravitational coupling constant here. And this delta is a symmetry parameter. So the model is defined up here in this part of space. And we now lower the bare cosmological constant to a critical value. So when we reach to this surface here, then the volume of the universe is going to infinity. So we have fixed this coupling function such that we stay close to this physical surface. We have a finite volume. We stay close to this. And when we increase this volume, we get closer and closer. So in a certain way, because the four volume and the cosmological constant are dual, we can say that for a given volume, effectively, we are using a cosmological constant, which is 1 over V in the simulation. So we are, of course, trying to be as close as possible to this surface. So basically, we have kind of two parameters, namely delta and kappa naught, the inverse bare gravitational coupling function, and this is symmetry parameter. Now, it turns out that there are three phases here. So I call them A, B, and C. And as you will see, phase A and phase B are not so interesting. So I show you here some snapshots of configuration in these phases. Phase A, so a typical configuration kind of looks like this. That's a number of kind of disconnected. So time direction is here. This is time direction. This is time direction. This is time direction. And what I plot here is the size of a spatial slice of volume here. So this is space volume. So you see that space is totally disconnected here in various sizes. They're fluctuating. This is actually a little bit misleading. If I take time to be larger, then these will be smaller. So they will just be small bit lumps in spatial universes, which are actually coming and going, being created and disappear again. So it is exactly what this space is. And well, it has a physical interpretation, which we can return to, but it's not interesting for us. It's not really, this is not how our kind of universe looks. Here in phase B, this is kind of the opposite of this. So here spatial volume wants to kind of distribute out over the whole time axis in small pieces which are not really fluctuating. Here, the whole spatial universe is concentrated on a single slice or two slices. So basically, there's a collapse of the time dimension. So what you see here, this line here, this is nothing. I mean, it's just computer technically we have put in that you cannot disconnect the time direction, else it would just have vanished. But now it is there. So space, the time direction has collapsed to nothing. But in phase C, we see a kind of genuine extended universe, just consisting of one blob. So if you put more and more volume in, it will not do like this. It will just stay here, and it will grow, and it will grow in an organized way, such that the spatial direction grows as the total 4 volume to the power 3 over 4, and the time direction grows as the total 4 volume to the power 1 fourth. Yeah.
Between the time and the space, so I can understand that you need to favor the closure structure, so you need to have some time direction. But why do you have the asymmetry parameter delta? Why shouldn't they scale the same, the time and the space?
Well, you see, well, it's once you have broken this symmetry, you should as well allow it as a parameter to see what happens. And the point is that if you really look in the nitty-gritty details of what we are doing, then we will see that while the space, the geodesic distance in space is well defined, really. When we talk about a time slicing, it is actually not exact. You know, you have these two time slices, but it's not that each point is exactly a geodesic distance A from the other one. It fluctuates within some limits, you know. So you don't have an exact time slicing. It's an approximate time slicing. So it's safer in a way to put in just a parameter and see what happens and see whether there's some region there where you have some good physics and not. And in fact, these things are dictated in part by this time asymmetry. So,
so there's
a point to have.
Yeah. Another question about the tuning of the cosmological constant or making the volume large. Basically, you have to tune the cosmological constant in order to get a microscopic universe in order to attain the continuum limit.
Sure.
And that's fine. Is there any way in which, in your approach, you can also keep the cosmological constant arbitrary and somehow reach some form of a continuum limit for generic values of lambda? Or you always have to have tuned lambda?
In a way, it would be much better to have a fixed value of the cosmological constant and then let the volume fluctuate as it likes to fluctuate. The problem is entirely the following technical thing, that if you do that, it turns out that the distribution of these four volumes is not pleasant. So it will typically be like say N4 to some power alpha. And then you have e to the minus lambda critical to N4, to a first approximation. And that's the distribution. Now, if you're not, so this is the bare cosmological constant. If you're not very close to this one, of course, everything is exponentially expressed, and you only see a few N4s. That's not interesting. So you have to fine-tune it to be very close to here. But the problem is
that when you make this sum here, because of this exponent alpha, it's actually this is converging this sum, even if you put this equal to this critical thing. You know? So even at the critical value, the average volume is just a few tetrahedra. But it's a power line distribution, so eventually when you simulate, you take extremely long detours out to large volumes, and then you come back again, and you spend all time, and then it goes out. So these power line distributions are unpleasant. I mean, in principle, you can work with them, but even in two dimensions, it was practically impossible to work with them. So it was much more convenient to say, okay, we simply drop this and we fix this in one by this Laplace transformation. But it wouldn't be nice to be able to do the other thing, but it's just technically very unpleasant to deal with.
But I mean, mathematically, it's the same. You're doing the same
thing. Well, yeah, it's the same in the sense that you're making a Laplace transformation, but still, it would be much nicer to have the real physical system as such, you know. But it's also true that you are quite interested in the critical behavior when this is just infinitesimally close to here, and these finite contributions play no role there. But they're dominating our computer simulations. But of course not observables, which depends on n, which are extensive. They will not feel them, but the computer stays there. So here's a quantitative phase diagram. So here we have dropped the cosmological constant, we keep the volume fixed and take it, of course, as large as we now can. This is what the real phase diagram, what it looks like. Here was phase C, where the extended block was. This was phase A out here, where we had this small disconnected string along the time direction. And here we had a collapse of space. So these points are all high quality, good points.
Locating this, these two also. This dotted line are just made for small systems, so the line is not so precise. But this is what it looks like. So delta was the asymmetry parameter between space and time.
What does it mean for it to be negative?
Well, it just means that you take the lattice spacing of time to be shorter than that of space.
Well, this is
so in a way it's a trivial thing. So what I'll show to you is that this line here is a first order transition. And the new thing here is that we now believe that this line here is a second order transition line. And so there are two points here which are distinct, namely the end point. So it ends here actually. So there is an end point here, and there is a kind of tree critical point here. So these two, of course, are interesting transition points, and I'll return to them later.
What's the order parameter?
The order parameter in a certain sense is the geometry, as shown in this picture. So the geometry is completely kind of different in the two phases. And you can then invent order parameters. I will show them in fact here. But I wouldn't say that these are very really deep order parameters. They're just parameters which change when you go from one base to another. So here we are. Here's the phase transition books. Go away. Sorry, it takes a little bit of time because the figure takes time sometimes to load here. This is the first order AC transition so between the extended phase and the one where time is kind of chopped up in small pieces. And so the order parameter is taken here. This is simply to be the number of vertices in the triangulation, and it can divide it by the number of force impulses. So it's not a deep physical parameter, but this is one which changes abrupt over the system when you go from one phase to another, simply because the geometry is completely different. And what you see here, so here's plotted this ratio as a function of computer time. So this is basically computer time kind of running here, and you see that it jumps between two values, basically. So there's a double peak, and that's exactly the sign of a typical first-order transition, that you have a discontinuous jump, that there's no smooth transition between the two. And well, we spent some time trying to find a good way to depict this. Well, this is the best we came up with. So up here, so here's the time axis. And up here, in the grading here, the gray grading, is the size of a spatial slice. So here's this is time, and you have the spatial slices here, and they have a certain tree volume. And you see here, when it's dark here, it means that it has a large tree volume. When there's nothing here, it means that there's almost no tree volume. So if you remember the shape of these things, then there was a block here, and then there was a stalk, which was basically at the cutoff scene. So this is what you see here. So here you have such a universe,
a real extended universe here. It doesn't seem to be very extended here, but it is really slightly more extended, but it's difficult to present graphically in a good way. Then it disappears here, so there's nothing. So we are here, then we jump up here, the order parameters change, so here there's basically
nothing. Then the universe comes back, it is recreated, but you see at a different point in time here. So the center of the mass is completely different. Then it disappears again, then it's recreated, then there's a long period here where there's nothing but small blocks of no real spatial extension, then it comes back and so on. So this is a kind of beautiful kind of realization of the universe being this extended universe being annihilated, created, so on. So there's a first order transition right here. And it behaves really like a first order transition, so this double peak that you see here becomes more and more important when you go to larger in force. And in the end it is just impossible to study in computer because it's just important to find this critical point when you're at one side, it stays there, and then you go to the other side, oops, it's there, and it cannot shift back and forth. But that's a typical sign of a first order phase transition. So now let's go to the other phase, the BC phase. So that's the phase between the extended universe and the one where time has collapsed, basically, so a few time steps, and the spatial universe is kind of very concentrated. And first, so first we didn't pay much attention to this phase transition line because we had this picture here. So it looked really like a first order transition. You see here. Here is another order parameter, which is more or less like the one. It is just So it's in four, and then some combinations of vertices and links, so it's just your in fact, it's a conjugate part of the action. So this delta, this asymmetry parameter, acts on certain parts of enforce and kind of not show the detailed action, it doesn't matter. So it's just a conjugate part, which is modifying delta. So you see clearly, first order transition, yes, seemingly. You have this double peak structure. And here we have again tried to plot it. So here we have put so here the universe is collapsed to two lattice time spaces here. But then here it becomes extended. You see here if there's some distribution of this thing here. We are here, then we go here, it's again kind of collapsed. And then it extends again. So it changes like a real first order transition. However, if you go to the next plot, we now do it for a much larger volume. And then we expected, and that was why we didn't investigate it before now, then we expected that we would see nothing. But in fact, we saw quite the opposite. What we saw here was that this, you see, the double peak has now almost vanished, it's still there. But you understand, and when you look at the transitions, there's not longer this well-defined sharp transition, and you see that space is more or less extended all the time. Sometimes it shrinks to almost nothing, but comes out again. So this signal is completely opposite to what you would expect from an ordinary first order transition. So our conjecture is now that the reason we saw this double peak, it was simply that the configurations that we looked at for convenience were quite small, because then everything goes faster on the computer, but it simply didn't have phase space enough in the calculations to explore the full set of configurations. So we enforced on it an artificial jump in configurations, which are not there when we go to large configurations. So So we now projected that this is a central transition, but we have no proof of this yet, I must say. So even if it turned out that it's in the end should be a first order transition, then the endpoints of such things could still serve as candidates for higher order transitions. It's a possibility, and it should be investigated. So we haven't investigated this. So there are these two points, the endpoint, this first line transition, and the triple point where the two lines, they meet and go into a third line. So these are, anyway, if this turned out maybe not to be a second order transition, they are candidates for a second order transition. And of course, we are interested in such a second order transition because we want to make kind of connection to the fixed point or the fixed line feature of the randomization group flow. And now let me try to convince you a little bit about that this is really something special. I mean, it's not just an arbitrary drop coming out of the computer here. So Renata has already shown this picture, so the time direction is here, and this profile is the spatial volume at each time slice. Yeah. And the round thing, well, it was just something I made for fun. There's no information in this, but somehow this picture of extended universe has stayed with us. But really, the information is in this curve here. So this is a typical kind of distribution. So it doesn't look anything like a nice round thing of any kind. So is this quantum fluctuation, a fluctuating universe around a semi-classical background? That's what one can ask. So the configuration, as we already discussed, consists of this block, and then the stalk here, which is at the cutoff scale. So here's an interesting question for you. So suppose that we have such a sequence of universes. Right now we're talking quantum cosmology. So how are we really making the superposition of these guys? Guess it's not clear. So we have taken the most simple-minded approach to this. So we have this whole sequence, maybe 10,000, 100,000 of these configurations. They're all fluctuating in various different shapes. You know. So how do you take the average of these? So we decided to locate what we call the center mass of this. Of course, there is not really something like a center mass, but you can, of course, look at the picture and you can define a center mass. And then we make a superposition such that we put the center mass on top of each other, and then we just average these distributions. And what do we get? So here's what we get, I already showed to you by Renata. So we get a distribution of three volumes as a function of the time step, which has this functional form. So there are two aspects of this kind of formula. So first of all, it has exactly this form, pro size q, so very good precision, and it scales with n, the total four volume, like n to the four step and n to three four step. In fact, we kind of made a fit to determine these exponents. So we put them in kind of like this, an arbitrary exponent here, and then the corresponding exponent here they kind of shoot it up. When you integrate this, it should give n4 by kind of definition, because the sum of these n3 should give the total volume. So there is this constraint in the scaling here. If you put it into a form like this, and then we try to determine the best d, and the best d comes out to be 4. Of course, it's numerical, so it's, you know, I think it was 4.02 plus minus 0.05. So it's not, of course, exactly 4. But with good precision, you can say that 4 is a reasonable candidate. So you put them all on top of each other, you use finite size scaling, and you determine this exponent. So you see that the three volume scales as the 4 volume to 3/4, and the time scales as 1/4. So they scale canonically. And of course, we have not put this in by hand. I mean, it comes out by itself. So this block organizes itself like this. But not only does it organize itself in such a scaling, also with this cosine q. And so how did you understand this cosine q? Well, so we went back to the old literature of a kind of mini superspace action. So if you only have, so what we are observing here is the scale factor, or the string volume, scale factor A cube is equal to the spatial volume. And of course, people play with this model in old days. That's also a kind of nuts set that, well, what do you do in quantum gravity when you're going to solve it? You kick out, you say, okay, let's assume that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. And then, of course, you're only left with the scale factor as a variable, and then you play with quantum mechanics of this thing. So that was what people did in the old space here. Here we have actually integrated out these odd degrees of freedom. And now we want to compare it with such a model here. And so this is just a model, and you can kind of discretize this if you want. So this is just a trivial kind of translation of this to a time sizing. And the relation between this coupling constant K1 and this G can be kind of worked out. It's given in this way here. So it's not, let me remind you about it, it's not, it was just a parameter which determined the width of this thing here in terms of, you take out this factor into one force and then this determines the width. So we have a straight and we have this formula here. It's just an naive translation. This C4 here is kind of related to the four volume of the tetrahedron. But yeah,
we'll get read about them, the ordering problem.
Well, I'm not getting rid of it. I'm just putting in this particular implementation here of the actions here. So I'm not solving the ordering problem in the sense that I'm not really quantizing this theory in any deep way. I'm just using this as a classical action at the moment. So of course, my starting point is the passing principle itself, the bottom is the passing principle, and I just want to fit this effective action here to the data. So when you solve for this, the classical solution to this mini state action is exactly cosine cube t divided by b, where you have some chosen some time, and the proper time is related to. In the following way, just some kind of standard formula. So this is what exactly what we observe. This is exactly what we observe. So that could be fitted very well to it, but maybe this may be a little bit further, because if you go back to the picture here, there's one more thing about this picture here. So here's the curve, and as Vlad already said, there are two curves here, in fact. There's a cosine cube, and there's the data points. You don't have to think the same on this plot here. But what I've shown here is a typical fluctuation of one configuration. So it's not the error bars of the feet or anything, because they're much, much smaller, the precision of 10,000 configurations. But for a single configuration, these are the error bars. So the universe typically fluctuates like you see here. So it's not that. I mean, so you see immediately that the universe is not large, because the whole universe fluctuates like this. So it's really a kind of quantum universe. Also, you can study the scaling of these error bars as a function of n4. And you see that they go down exactly as the square root of n4. So the larger and larger universe, it becomes more and more semi-classical. You can say less and less quantum fluctuations. That's exactly what you hope for. But the actual size of our universe is like this, so it's not large at all. It's a quantum universe, but seemingly still, when you insist on taking the average many, many configurations, it works out that this formula here, this it fixes very well. So now let me impress you a little bit, at least I was myself surprised how well it worked. So we want now to study the quantum fluctuations around this. So we have this universe, it clearly fluctuates. So now let us just do it in a most naive way in the mini superspace thing, that we simply take the classical action and we expand the quantum fluctuations here. And we can, of course, so we can do this analytically. This is what we've done here. So we have just this classical, we have the mini superspace action, when we expand, we get something here, where this is Hamiltonian. And one can solve this
Hamiltonian, if not analytically, then numerically. you can just solve for the eigenvalues here
this Hamiltonian. But we can of course do the same in our computer simulations, because now we have what we can measure. We can measure the so this x is the fluctuation of the starting point, and we can measure the correlation between x of t1 and x of t2 also in the computer simulations, because we have already now determined the average size of the universe by all these superpositions, and then for the individual universe we now know how it kind of differs. So here is the analytic formula that you can calculate. This is just the inverse of this Hamiltonian here. And numerically, we can just measure this correlation function here. And then we can calculate the eigenfunctions corresponding to the Hamiltonian. There are, of course, also the eigenfunctions corresponding to this matrix, because if you don't look at the zero modes, they have, of course, the same spectrum, this C and H. And here, from this, we just have a matrix. We can just find the eigenfunctions corresponding to this. And here's a plot of some of them. So no parameters here are put in, except that we, of course, we will adjust the T, B, to this kind of discretized thing. So this is the only thing we need to put in these fields. And they almost fit spot on. So we conclude that the kind of quadratic approximation to mean superspace action describes the measured quantum progressions very well. So what is the size of our quantum universe now? So we can only express it in terms of lattice spaces. Now let us do that. So this is done for a particular value of this bare coupling function, the inverse gravitational coupling function, and this asymmetry parameter. So we've chosen these because we like these, because the universe, they look very nice. So there's nothing deep about it. So we are deep into the C phase where these extensions are. We are not close to the boundaries. And then the universe looks kind of round and nice. So we saw it through some high precision measurements there. But again, we have to keep track of how large systems are we really talking about here. So we have typically the largest systems, we have these kind of 360,000 force synthesis. But these are synthesis, so if you want to build them, put them together to a hypercubes, in fact, 9 to the fourth is exactly what is the number of these hypercubes. So the universe is not very large, but again, I remind you that very interesting physics in QCD and so on has been extracted from lattices of this size. So it's not a total disaster. It would, of course, be much better to have a much larger universe. But unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult, again, for computer technical reasons. It is not so much that we cannot fit a larger universe into the computer. It can be done. But it's just the annoying fact that the updating procedure that we use, which is a simple Metropolis updating because that's the only one we have available for changing the geometry, is a local one. It works very slowly. So typically, at the moment, it takes 1 month for the largest configurations here to thermalize. So these are the rules of the game. So clearly, there are room for thermalize to improve the computer algorithm, but I have actually not been one of them, so but maybe one of the young guys, they actually have some ideas how to improve. So one can hope that can be done. But I can remind you that we have this relation between G. This is the continuum gravitation coupling constant coming from this mini superspace approximation, and then the lattice spacing. And K1, which was just constantly in front of this mini superspace action. So we can measure this K1. From studying these fluctuations, we get an explicit expression for K1. So we know K1. And so we just put in, we have G here, we have A here, we have K1, and we get a relation like this for this choice of coupling constants. Now, taking the square root of G to be the Planck length, then we see that the Planck length is 1/2 of the lattice space. So we are not sub-Planckian yet. It would have been very nice if we were sub-Planckian, because what we really want to study is the sub-Planckian physics. I mean, we would like this to be a UV spaces, and in order to prove that, I mean, you better go to some Planck and Planck distances. But unfortunately, we are not there yet. But still, I mean, it's not so bad, but it could be much better. So if you put in all the other numbers, then the radius of this is of this Cartesian space, because that is exactly what the solution, the classical solution was. The radius is this. So pi times the radius is the distance on the Cartesian space, the geodesic distance. So the diameter of the Cartesian space, you can say, is depending on the lattice size we use here, kind of 12 to 20 Planck lengths for the enforce that we use. So one could hope for better, but still, even surprising for me that with this small size of the universe, seemingly it fits very well to this semi-classical form. But now, can we do better? And here is where I would love to make contact to the randomization group people, and where I haven't succeeded to do it very well yet, I must confess. So we have these formulas. V4 is equal to this. G is equal to this thing here. This was again the constant in front of our discretized mini superspace action. So we view this G as a physical G, which should describe the gravitational interaction, because it's a coupling constant in front of our mini superspace action, which is the continuum Einstein Hilbert action. So what I would like to do now, since I unfortunately cannot make too much contact to the randomization group, and I'll try to discuss maybe why, well, it fails until now. What I can do, what is conceptually clear at least, is that I can try to stay on a line of constant physics. By constant physics, I mean that I keep this continuum B4 fixed, I keep this continuum coupling G fixed, and I now change my bare coupling constants here in such a way that I get into sub-Planck, such that the lattice spacing is much, much smaller than the Planck space. So this clearly means that this K1 should be very, very small. In fact, when I put this in, I get A as a function of N4. And then I put this in here, and I see that in order to stay on constant G physics, I have to adjust these coupling functions here in such a way that K1 scales to 0 as 1 over A to the 4th. Then I will stay on constant physics. I mean, I might not be able to kind of do that. In this model, we don't have any choice. I mean, this is given to us by measurement. We can adjust these coupling functions, and we can just see what happens. So here's K1, and here I have kept the delta, the asymmetry parameter fixed, but I changed the bare inverse gravitation coupling constant. So I go to larger and larger inverse gravitation coupling constant. So smaller and smaller value of the bare gravitation coupling constant in there. And when I come up to around 4.5, I'm reaching the phase transition point between phase C, the extended phase, and A, the one where you have these small drops in the time direction. And you see that it drops when you move this way. We haven't, so these measurements are a little bit old, so we haven't moved further than this, but it is tending to conjecture that it actually goes to 0. So that's good news in the sense that then we might be able to penetrate into the sub-Planckian regime. So why haven't we done it yet? Well, it turns out that when you get closer and closer to the phase line, also, the simulations become more and more difficult, so there are only technical obstacles. But in principle, it can be done here. So here's the other transition, and it turns out that this is probably the most interesting one. So here I change the symmetry parameter. When delta goes towards zero, I approach the phase transition line between the extended phase and the one where time has collapsed. And also there, it seems that indeed K1 has a tendency to fall, and one should follow this line even further. And well, we will do that, but again, it requires a lot of analysis to extract these K1s, one should analyze the whole kind of correlation matrix and time. Space and spatial volume kind of correlation, so it's not going to work. But let us just discuss the possible continuum limits. Or so there's a kind of scenario one, and that's definitely a possibility. Not what I would like most, but it's a possibility. That what we are seeing here is just another effective field theory. So so suppose that this K1 cannot go to zero. Then seemingly it's difficult to get to the sub-Planckian regime. So somehow, no matter what we do, the Planck lengths will always be identified with the cutoff. So there are two attitudes here. Other one says, well, that's just it. I mean, the model is just an effective model, but maybe there is no theory of gravity. Or maybe gravity wants to tell us something deep that you cannot probe the ultraviolet parameter. So that we don't know, of course, at the moment. But even if you could take A to zero, when we hit some phase boundary, it is, of course, not obvious that the limit will be interesting. It could be uninteresting. And we have plenty of such examples in quantum field theory. The Higgs-Gates sensor of the standard model is one, where if you look at the transition between the broken and the unbroken phase, it's basically a first-order transition. But you can even find, it's a complicated phase diagram, I don't want to discuss it, but I don't want to say, you can find regions where it's actually a second-order transition, but the second-order transition is just the one, the mean field of the easing model, and so on. So, I mean, one needs to do more work, of course, in order to see that it's an interesting, non-trivial kind of limit. An even better example, maybe, I would like to emphasize, is the lattice compact U1 model in three dimensions. So this is an interesting model because it actually has, so it's just the model of the photon. But it, on the lattice, it's non-trivial because there are lattice monopoles. So these lattice monopoles, they're lattice artifacts, but they act entirely as real monopoles in all respects and interactive with field theory. And already Poliakov understood this long ago, that this model, in many ways, are physically identical to what is called the Jordi-Glashow model in three dimensions. So the Jordi-Glashow model is the SO3 gauge model with Higgs in the joint representation. And this model has monopoles. And when you go to a Cretan space, this was the first model, and I think the only model where to some degree of rigor has proven confinement fractions. And the monopoles, they play an important role. And in fact, the same is true on the lattice. So these lattice monopoles, they make this a confining series for any finite value of the gauge coupling. But the continuum limit is when the gauge coupling goes to infinity and the lattice spacing shrinks to zero. And the mass of the monopoles is their inverse to A, to one over the lattice spacing. So they become infinitely heavy. And they decouple. So the ultraviolet limit of this model is trivial. It's just a free photon. But for any finite value of A, it's non-trivial and it contains exactly the non-perturbative dynamics of the Jordi-Glashow model. But of course, the two models are not ultraviolet identical. I mean, they're simply different in the ultraviolet. So the lattice model is trivial in the ultraviolet, while the continuum model is, of course, non-trivial. And the analogy between these two, they break down exactly when we come to the mass of the W and Higgs particles in the continuum model. So when we try to penetrate further into the ultraviolet, the two models kind of diverge. But nevertheless, this model captures all the non-perturbative physics associated with confinement. So it's a very good effective model. And it was understood by Poliakov almost in the same article where he proposed this thing. He also said that this lattice model was an ideal kind of realization of this situation. Similar thing you can say about U1 in four dimensions, but let me skip this. Of course, the obvious analogy of this, one obvious analogy of this is that we have this lattice model of quantum gravity, but it doesn't have an interesting UV completion. Another theory, it could be strange theory, it could be another, whatever theory, it seems that I already have an infinite list of possible candidates for this. but whatever, some other theory could be needed for this. But what I want to emphasize here is it doesn't rule out that you can investigate with this model interesting non-perturbative physics, exactly like you can do it for the E1 lattice theory, even if the UV limit is trivial. But of course, scenario two is much more interesting, and non-trivial scaling. So the best thing is of the potential possibility is along this transition line BC between the extended phase and the one where time direction kind of collapses. So let's assume that it's a second order transition, and there is some, I think, reasonable evidence that this could be the case. So I'm flashing this formula here. So the situation at the moment is, well, so we haven't really made the full analysis yet about what happened with the effective action and how we extract this consequence when we approach this line. We have identified where the precise line is, and the next step is, of course, to make the complete analysis of the effective action when you approach. But we have done it for some selected points, and I've taken two here. So still here we are far from the actual transition line. So I showed you this formula here. So G is the continuum gravitation coupling constant, A is the lattice spacing, and this K1 is the coupling constant in front of the mean superspace discretized action, which we can measure. And I told you that it was kind of decreasing, which was good news. However, unfortunately, this good news is counteracted by bad news. And the bad news is that actually the extension, so when you approach this line, time is shrinking. So the time extension of the universe is shrinking. So I show you here the two volume, three volume profiles. So here, for this asymmetrical, we're equal to 0.6, and here equal to 0.2. And you see that time has shrunk. Of course, since the volume is the same, then the spatial volume here has to grow. But the important point is that time has kind of shrunk here. So this means that this parameter S, which basically measures the temporal extension of this, is also getting smaller. So K1 is getting smaller, and S is getting smaller. And in fact, they're getting smaller in such a way that for these two values here, this part of the equation is basically unchanged. So this means that this A, the relation between A and G is not changing. And that's, of course, that points, of course, to the kind of scenario that where you cannot penetrate Kaplan-Jordan plane space. I mean, the lattice spacing, you cannot make the lattice space smaller. But we don't know, so this is just two values that we are still far away, in a way, from the exact kind of region. So it might be that when it shrinks even further, that this decline is much faster than this. As you see here, let me go back and show you the curve. So you see here, it starts to dip very, very steeply here. So it could go very fast to zero. And from this point of view, there's been a definitely hope that one can penetrate there the subprime condition. But I'm honest with you, so I say we simply don't know anymore. A lot of work has to be done there, clearly, in order to get to it. Now, the change of K1, so this is just what I said, seems to be compensated by this. But it is indeed possible that this scenario that we have here breaks down when we approach this critical line. So we have this formula between the time extension and the four volume here, into the force. And this constant here, it goes seemingly to zero. The this goes to zero when we approach the critical line. So this is very suggestive for the fact that when we come to the critical line, one should in fact change the scaling relation here, not to be like this, but to be with a new critical exponent. And this, in fact, I'm giving a talk later today, and this relation will actually allow us to relate this position tentatively, but the work is to the Pochava-like scenario, where asymmetric scaling between time and space appears. But we don't know anything about here. I mean, from a point of view of ordinary gravity, it would, of course, be preferable that just this goes slower to zero than K1, and then one can penetrate into this sub-Planckian regime. But we don't know what's happening. So let me just summarize here what is the situation. So the lattice gravity phase diagram has a region with a potentially can kind of correct infrared behavior, namely this region C, where we have this extended sink. Similarly, it gives you the Euclidean de Sitter space solution there. And I have the critical line, the BC line, where non-trivial continuous limit is a possibility. Also, I would say that this line, I think approaching this line, is needed in order, unfortunately, in order to make contact, quantitative contact to the randomization group, because the formula I have shown to you until now just shows a triple scaling of the gravitational coupling constant. I mean, so still, I mean, the data I showed to you, even if I change these coupling constants in the region where we are away from the phase boundary, I can change this bare coupling, but it doesn't scale in any monstrous way. I can always map it back to a perfectly spherical S4 solution by just kind of redefining time. So clearly something non-trivial should happen when you approach this line, and in order to make contact with this. Well, there is, of course, the possibility that the CCT theory is only an effective field theory where transplantian regions cannot be reached. I mean, one has to face this fact that it's a possibility. This is, I think, a little bit of an exaggeration. I mean, many aspects in terms of it can be tested, I say, in principle, yes. I must admit that we haven't tested them yet. I had hoped, preparing for this talk, that I could come up with something better than what I did, but I mean, until now, because of this scaling is so trivial of G and the K1, we have not been able to find the correction to scale yet, telling us that we have a running coupling constant. So how would we see something like this? So let me just end with this remark, if I can find this slide here. Yeah, so kind of typically what we need is to see that this perfect finite size scaling here, it doesn't apply any longer, because now the effective scale is really set by the square root of N4. Because we have V4 and we have G, and we want to see that they do not just satisfy some trivial canonical relation, but that there's some if this was not exactly like this, then there's a possibility that the derivation from this game here can be shifted into the K1 coupling constant, which then becomes a function of the scale. And in this way, one would be able to derive a changing kind of gravitational coupling constant as a scale. So my hope is that when we go closer to the phase line, we do not see this in this simple form any longer. So this natural behavior will be good in two ways, both maybe relating to the gravitational coupling and maybe relating to Pochard. So all possibilities are open at the moment, so that's a good thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this great talk.
Now
there are
actually, I have a couple of questions. So first is, I thought that CDT is based on the fact that it doesn't matter what the actual shape of the fundamental building blocks is, right?
Yeah.
So now what you're changing the relative lengths between the time and the spatial. So
yeah.
And so that would be my first question. Second,
yes,
was, since you're using numerics, right, and this is a numerical result, how do you know, or how did you convince yourself that that is not a numerical artifact, this space theory?
Well, to take the last question first, a phase diagram is what it is. I mean, you're always doing numerical simulations. You're trying to do your best to see that you have a first order transition. It's like in nature. I mean, something changes, you call it a phase transition. And
no, I agree, but for example, if I'm doing any numerics, I mean, it's a very naive way to look at it, maybe, but if I change my grid size or things like that, right, I can get a different result, which is entirely depends because, you know, the numeric spread. I mean, I'm just wondering.
Yeah, well, that's of course what you have to check, that, that this is not a, an artifact of your, but there's no canonical way to do it. I mean, you put a physical system on the computer, say, and you either you solve your differential equations, kind of deterministic, as you were saying, and then of course you have to make sure that the errors there do not propagate. I mean, you always when you solve your differential partial differential equation on the computer, you always put in checks that then do not accumulate errors. And well, we know that if you discretize things, they will run away unless you use good algorithms and take care of this thing. So that's kind of trivial. So you try to do your best, and similar here with Monte Carlo simulations. Well, you try to do your best. You investigate the signature of these transitions, and but I don't see why there should be any problem. You see, as what we see here is a signal which looks perfectly like a first order. These are kind of statistical systems, and so they look like a phase transition. Why shouldn't they be phase transition? I mean, if they follow all the characteristics of phase transitions, I would say they are phase transitions. But I don't know why you doubt it, but okay. But of course, you are trying. There's always a danger that you are kind of misled. Not so much about the phase transitions, but a more subtle thing is exactly the order of the transition. That's a subtle thing. So you have a first order transition, you have higher order transitions, and they're all characterized in different ways, and you have to check these parameters. Mm. That's what we are doing. So, well, some of the characteristics I showed to you was indeed of a first order transition, but I also showed to you exactly an example where we were misled and doing it better. We changed our minds that it was not a first order transition, but maybe more like a second order transition. But we haven't proven it now. How do you prove it's a second order transition? You find an observable, some susceptibility, which is typically the kind of derivative of some of the terms in the action. And you show that when you go to larger and larger volumes, this the peak of this susceptibility will grow in a special way. This is a function of the volume that you use. So typically you have something like V of the volume, so some power nu. And if this nu is different from 1, then you know that it cannot be a first order transition because then it will grow like the four volume. So that's how you do it in practice. So returning to your first question, well, indeed, you expect kind of universality of the building blocks to some extent. But of course, you cannot push this arbitrarily. And well, in this case here, you can say, let me see if I can find the phase diagram. Now I get all these tools. Right. But this is typically what it looks like when you want to analyze this thing. So let me find the phase diagram. So indeed, in this region here, there is exactly the kind of universality that you say. So you can map all the configurations that you find here, all the correlation functions that we measure, can, if you're not too close to these lines, can be mapped into each other by a simple rate definition of the time, as you would have expected. So that's really sad. But seemingly you cannot push this thing too much, then something else happens. And this is always the danger that you have when you have when you take a kind of discretization of a system. then you always run the risk that the system will doing something that you did not expect in the continuum and which you maybe don't want. This is if you take an ordinary differential equation and you discretize it. I mean, if you take delta t too large, then you run into solutions which are not continuum solutions, but something completely different. So you always have this risk. And seemingly here, adjusting the asymmetry too much, somehow this discretized Einstein action that we have, it does something which is unexpected. But, so the next question is there any physics in this sense? And And indeed, there is a physics in this. So actually, thanks for bringing up the questions, because I didn't. So let me use 1 minute to talk about it. So let us take this transition here. So seemingly here we have this nice extended universe, and exactly what is happening here. That the universe kind of disintegrate completely into small oscillating spatial universes in the time direction. So exactly what is that telling us? Well, my interpretation of this, I mean, we have no analytical proof of this, but my interpretation of this is the following. So what you know is that Euclidean quantum gravity is, of course, unbounded from below. So it doesn't make sense. Euclidean quantum gravity as such doesn't make sense, if you put it in the passing spot. It's unbound from below. You have to regularize it in some way. You have to make a linear configuration like Hawking did, or you have to do like we do, put in a cutoff, and so on. So in kind of this phase here, in the phase C, kind of seemingly there is a interplay between the entropy of the configurations and the actions and the cutoff in such a way that a continuum limit comes out, which is exactly like the Einstein classical solution. But if you go here, so here you are, when you go this way here, you are decreasing the bare gravitational property function. So the action, oops. We have space here. So recall that the action is 1 over g log the bare gravitational property function times something. Mm-hmm. So you have this part of the thing, e to the minus this part of the thing, and then you have some factor here, e to something else, which is entropy. You know, so these things they come together in some kind of complicated way, but it is clear that when we take this bare property to be sufficiently large, then the bad aspects of this action is going to dominate. So what are the bad aspects of this action? This is that you have a conformal factor with the wrong sign. So let us just write it like t squared. So what configurations would that like to generate? How does this get unbound? Well, it gets unbound by oscillating infinitely fast in the time direction. And this is exactly what we see. So the thing in this direction is relatively clear from time. Going this way here, this is the symmetry factor, is more subtle, but seemingly it could be related. There could be some definite physics related to this that we are we have the potential. The model is a simple model, and it has the potential to treat time and space kind of differently, and because we have broken the symmetry between space and time. And this line here might be the line where this is happening. So when we approach this line, maybe space is treated different from time. So it's a real physical thing. And then you can ask, is there any system where this could happen? And well, until recently there was not. But maybe now there is a system with the Hochschild gravity. So there's no simple answer to your question, but there's still physics in this thing.
So I think
there was
only one more.
Let's
say two more.
I'll try to be shorter.
My question is brief. It was just about the invariant distance, and you used the matter field.
Yes.
Is it necessary, even for instance, in four dimension or higher, where you could have propagating degrees of freedom in gravity alone?
No. I entirely agree with you. Let me just go to the problem.
Do a three dimensional analysis.
No. I mean, you don't need the matter field, but it was more clear in the case of the matter field, maybe. So there is a.
So just at the beginning.
So if you wanted a pure kind of geometric definition, then you put in just one here and one here, and you just leave out the matter field completely. Mm-hmm. Then you sum over this, and you get basically the universe where you have two points which are separated like this.
A quick question. In the mini-superspace approximation, your solution, does it solve Einstein's equations in mini-superspace, or do you have to flip the sign of in the potential term?
It solves, in the potential term.
I think it
solves Einstein's equations. Yeah, it solves Einstein's equations.
Okay. So you don't have to change the sign in the...
Well, the whole sign is changed. I mean, but the combination is A dot A squared plus A is the correct one for solving Einstein's equation. And that's so I can tell you this term here, this is of course the curvature term coming back. And we used a lot of time to decide that it comes out with the right coefficient. It's extremely difficult to do that. Because as you know, we have the computer simulations. And it's completely dominated by the kinetic term. Just in order to pass this through, the kinetic term dominates over the potential term. So measurement of this tells you this just from the calculation was very difficult. But we waited a lot of time, and it comes out, well, we can say the following. It comes out right in terms of scaling exponents, fine. And the coefficient is not incompatible with the right coefficient. But that's the best we can do. But then, when we take this and we solve for the modes and we compare to our modes that we have, we see this nice agreement. And that convinced me that the coefficient was right, even if you cannot measure it kind of directly. Because you can, of course, play with the mini-superspace model, drop this term or put in something else, and then you get different modes, and they do not fit, they do not fit as well. So I think that this is, in a way, a kind of remarkable result, because it shows that in this region of phase space, similarly, we have a similar thing that you have in ordinary field theory, that the k-squared term is, of course, infrared dominant. So you always flow to that point automatically. And you would think that if you had a diffeomorphism than regularization, you should always, well, that's what people say, and that's what I'm saying, you should flow to the Einstein term. Because that's, so seemingly in the region C, this is satisfied in our process. It's not put in by hand. So that was remarkable, I thought. But it might break down when we come to the
position. Okay, I think we have to stop at this point and have a coffee, and I would propose we reconvene at past 11:40.